Good morning and welcome. The next matter on our docket bears docket number Androscoggin 22-317, State of Maine versus Jacob Labby Sr. The matter is in order for oral argument here today. Counsel are present. We will be streaming this argument live on our internet streaming portal. For that reason, I'll ask counsel please stand, identify yourselves and the party you represent. First for the appellant.
Good morning. Attorney Vern Parity for Mr. Labby.
Good morning. And for the appellee.
Good morning. Assistant District Attorney Catherine Hudson McCrae for the state.
And good morning to you. Attorney Parity, we'd be happy to hear you on behalf of your client.
May it please the court. The question I have is, can I call the police and press charges against the people that call me every single day about my car warranty expiring? Can I call the police and press charges against clients that call me every single day about their cases? What happens if I change my phone number and the car warranty company still find me and call me? They don't threaten me. They don't follow me, although it does certainly seem it. Is that stalking? I feel harassed. I feel annoyed. I'm irritated. I want to throw the phone and I want to use bad words to the people who call me. Is that stalking is the question. Is that a course of conduct that would cause a reasonable person to suffer from one of the five things the legislature has indicated? And in this case, the only thing at issue here is whether it would cause someone to suffer serious inconvenience or emotional distress. If I am in prison and I call my ex and I'm allowed to speak with my child while I'm in prison, and after 3 years I get out and I want to see my child, not only that, I get sent home with prison clothes and have no clothing, but my spouse has them in her possession, and I text her and I call her, I don't threaten, I don't get angry, I simply ask to see my son and my clothes. That's what's stalking in this case. That's where we are. Is it harassment? Maybe. Is it something else? Maybe. Is it a Class C felony stalking charge? And that's what we're here to decide, whether this statute is clear enough so all of us know what the line is between repeated requests and breaking the law. Happy to answer questions if my 2 minutes isn't up.
It's always dangerous when you use yourself as an example, but you teed it up, so let's use you.
Sure.
Someone is calling you. They want to repossess your car, or a client who had an unhappy result is relentlessly calling you day and night, calling you 3 a.m, calling you your business phone, tying up your phone, and you say, stop it, stop it. You're not my client anymore. Go away. The calls continue, and you start to develop insomnia. You can't sleep at night. You're dreaming about this. And you disconnect all your phones, and you park your car across town where it's not visible. It's relentless. Doesn't that behavior come to a point where the person is producing a level of emotional distress and serious inconvenience that it does cross over the line between just someone being a pest and this relentless interference with your well-being?
Sure, and I guess I would just say that's going to open a huge can of worms. Then where do we draw the line?
Now, so let me ask you this, sure. Just to add on to Justice Mead's hypo. What if you then go out and get a protection order, and you serve that protection order on the caller, and the calls continue?
So in this case, there was a temporary order, and as the court is up, if we're going hypothetical, without the facts of this case, because in this case, there was some evidence whether there was confusion about whether it was issued, and it was issued late on. However, having said that, that's a violation of protection order. We have a law for that. The stalking statute doesn't say if you violate a protection order, you're guilty of stalking. The legislature could not have intended this type of behavior to be stalking. When they wrote this, statute, they had to have been intending this to be the domestic violence situation.
The violations of his order, the repeated calls, the past relationship, his past history, one call was breathing into the phone but nobody speaking. That puts it all in context as to whether or not it had an effect and a reasonable person would be emotionally distressed as a result of this conduct. And under the stalking, that could be a violation, correct? With the proper context.
I suppose, but that leads me to the point of, so just like Justice Stewart said, prior, without the prior, this guy's prior history, Mr. Labby's prior history, this, in his mind, probably wasn't stalking.
No, but that puts it in context, and it goes to the element of stalking as to whether a reasonable person would emotionally suffer as a result of this conduct.
So in the car warranty issue, I can say I did some research and I found out that the owner of that company has a ton of prior criminal histories, including assaults, those types of things.
Wait a minute.
That's what I'm asking.
Common law is a lot different than a domestic relationship between two people.
Sure.
And the emotions associated with that. You can't compare that.
Okay, Your Honor, I agree. But where do we draw the line between wanting to see your child and having to go without underwear?
And I think you put your finger on it. Where do we draw the line?
Right.
There's a certain level of repetitive actions that can just, it's being a pest, you're being an annoyance. And one where it really crosses the line, where it's causing serious emotional distress and inconvenience. But in many of the criminal laws, we leave it to the jury to decide what is reasonable. I mean, as you know, you well know, that what a reasonable person would do in a circumstance is undefined. We tell the jury that. It's to you to determine whether under these circumstances this was reasonable or unreasonable. So it seems to me here that the legislature has established these definitions. But as you say, they didn't give us a line. But don't we always hand off to the jury to decide where that line is?
Okay, but why don't we define what a reasonable person is in the seat of the defendant? A reasonable person would not consider this to be stalking. I want my underwear. I want to see my
kids.
Well,
you don't think so, but the jury did. And isn't that why we have juries?
Well, let's be clear about this, because that brings me to one of my points in the brief. Just like Justice Stewart said, his prior history, which I objected to, he's violated prior court orders. He went away to jail, basically, for 3 years. He just got out. He didn't see his son for 3 years. I mean, like I said in my brief, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know this guy's been in jail. He's violated orders in the past. He must be guilty of stalking. How about we try that case without his prior history and see what the jury says?
The jury could understand why she's emotionally distressed about it.
This isn't a
divorce, a happily ended divorce where they're all speaking and it's just a misunderstanding.
Sure.
This is somebody who has a history with her.
Okay, but you need both things. You need the course of conduct that is specifically defined as following, monitoring, tracking, observing, surveilling, threatening. We have none of that. So we're left with harassing or communicating. Communicating? I'm communicating with you right now.
Well, why couldn't a jury could have found, I don't know if you were the trial attorney, but the defense attorney could argue he wasn't harassing her, he was just trying to see his child. Prosecution's going to argue, no. He was harassing her. This wasn't about seeing the child.
So let's do this on a level playing field. Let's not tell the jury this guy's a bad guy who violates court orders all the time. Let's try that case and see if the jury finds him guilty of stalking.
And
I suggest it's a different result.
To your second point here, which we probably should talk about, mm-hmm. Justice Schreiber and others mentioned, it depends on context. And part of the context was here, it wasn't Ozzie and Harriet, who had a little tiff. This people have some history, and her fear, whether it was reasonable or not, really it's kind of tied into what happened before here. And the judge allowed some comment to the fact that, he's been out of the area and things like that. But during the course of the trial, various things occurred that probably telegraphed to the jury that he was in trouble for similar behavior in the past. That's your second point,
right?
We should talk about here. And I wanted to ask you whether the cat was really out of the bag kind of early on in this, whether the evidence about the fact that he had been previously incarcerated for violation, and in the opening statement, the closing statement was addressed, and in the opening statement, the jury heard that counsel wanted to touch briefly on the state's reference to violating previous court orders. The judge is going to give you an instruction that you cannot consider his violation of prior protection orders in determining whether he committed this offense. And then in closing, just to clear up the mistake, I was thinking about the protection order arguments. I'll say there's evidence of him violating protection orders. I meant to say court orders. So the cat was kind of out of the bag, wasn't it, from the start?
Sure. And in my defense, I had to address it because pre-trial we had that argument, yeah. And the judge was going to let it come in. So I had to try to
Absolutely.
Preempt it.
Yeah, you had
so
the front
otherwise, I would not have made those arguments
at all.
No,
I agreed. I agree. But the judge attempted to characterized in a way that was somewhat neutral, you know, that there was, he'd been away for a while and things like that. But it evolved, the victim blurted out, you know, during her testimony, actually in response to cross-examination, I think, that, you know, you have some money of his? Yeah, I have some money, but I was going to give it back to him when he got out. Boom, okay, got out. We know what that means. But the judge offered corrective instructions about the limited use of that, and we have to trust the jurors will follow the instructions, that it's not admissible to prove the truth of the matter asserted, but it's simply to show the context. And a later instruction was declined, waived.
Sorry, I interrupted you, but this court is well aware of how I feel about jury corrective instructions, but that's regardless. I understand the law is the law, and I can only fight one battle at a time. The problem is the legislature doesn't say what a reasonable person, let's consider a person's criminal background. Let's consider, despite 403 and 404, let's consider those things. If the legislature said those were relevant facts, then maybe we'd have a different story. But that goes back to my point that the statute, Mr. Labby would have had no way, I wouldn't have known. I am sorry, I'm a lawyer, and I wouldn't have known that was harassment. I wouldn't have known that was stalking.
Well, you just kind of answered your own question, though, didn't you?
Yes, but that's what my point is. It can't just be harassment, right? There has to be more. It has to be raised.
One of the elements is the victim has to suffer emotional distress. And right. My question to you is the past history of the defendant here, are you arguing is not probative? Or that under 403, the prejudice outweighs whatever probative value there was.
Okay, what is a reasonable person? Now, there's no definition, but it's not a subjective standard. It's not what I would feel. It's what a reasonable person would feel.
So, isn't it a reasonable person in the position of the alleged victim of stalking?
I mean,
doesn't that make the victim's knowledge of Mr. Labby's prior behavior relevant to her response to it?
Sure. And I can appreciate that argument, Your Honor. But again, I'm looking at the statute as a layperson that says I intentionally and knowingly do these things. And Mr. Labby was clearly not intentionally or knowing, meaning to stalk her. He was trying to see his child and get his belongings because he had, and it was right in the trial, he had no underwear.
Could the jury believe or find that that wasn't his purpose? He wouldn't, why did he call on the phone and just breathe and not answer it? Why did he make some of the other statements he said? Why did he text some of the things he did? But my question to you again is, are you saying it's not relevant, his past history is not relevant, or that if it is relevant, the prejudice outweighs the relevance under 403?
Well, I think it has some relevance. I think I'd lose credibility if I didn't agree with you on that. But I think the unfair prejudice significantly outweighs it. He's violated orders in the past. He's a stalker. He's domestically violent. I mean, that's what we think of when stalking, right? That's the first thing a layperson thinks of when they hear stalking. They think of following or tracking somebody who's their domestic spouse or their partner. That's what comes to your mind, not calling or texting about seeing your son.
Counsel, that was in the previous statute. The legislature amended the statute to specifically broaden it to cover this kind of conduct as a precautionary measure. The legislature made that clear.
Am I allowed to respond?
Answer.
I'd look to you. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds, but no, I don't have it.
Go right ahead.
Now I forgot the question, but I was not aware that this had been amended, and I'm not entirely sure what the last statute said. So I don't know that I can answer that question, especially now that I'm under the spotlight. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Attorney Hudson McCray would be happy to hear you on behalf of the appellee, State of Maine.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court. As some of the questions indicate this morning to opposing counsel, context, relationship between the parties, and history matters. And I'd like to focus my argument of three of the four issues raised by the appellant. First, Maine stalking statute is constitutional. Second, appellant's conduct was not de minimis. And finally, the trial court did not abuse its discretion or clearly err by admitting certain evidence at trial pursuant to Rule 403 or 404B. First, Maine's stalking statute is not unconstitutionally vague when applied to the facts of this case. The plain language of the statute is defined sufficiently such that ordinary people can understand the prohibited conduct. And here, the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that Jacob Labby engaged in a course of conduct that caused the victim and would have caused a reasonable person, as Justice Horton noted in the questions to opposing counsel, to suffer serious inconvenience or emotional distress. The conduct began the weekend of November 15th of 2019, when the victim dropped off her son, who she shares with the defendant, at his residence. At the end of that weekend, the victim had to get law enforcement involved to get her son returned to her. And as a result of what happened, the victim withheld her son from school and obtained a protection from abuse order. While law enforcement tried to serve Labby with the protection order, and even once the protection order was served, he persisted contacting the victim despite her asking him to stop, to be left alone, and blocking him on social media and by phone. Between November 15th and December 3rd, Jacob Labby caused the victim to experience heightened anxiety and distress, including suffering pregnancy complications. In totality, Labby's conduct falls squarely within the plain language of a stalking statute. Second, Labby's behavior was not de minimis, as his conduct did in fact cause the harm sought to be prevented by the legislature for both stalking, which was intended to broadly protect victims, as is referenced in the state's brief, and violating the protection from abuse order. And although Labby argues that his conduct as to the violations of the protection order convictions was de minimis because his behavior was not, quote, threatening or intimidating, those elements are not required by the language of the protection order statute. And again, the victim repeatedly asked Jacob Labby to stop, to leave her alone, and evidence at trial established that he understood the protection order, and yet he persisted in contacting her. So applying the Cargar factors here, it cannot be said that Labby's conduct was de minimis as to both stalking and violating the protection orders. Finally, the court properly admitted evidence that Labby had previously violated a court order and had been away for years. As Justice Mead noted in questions to opposing counsel, it was the defendant that opened the door in his opening statement that it was prior protection orders. The court left it open very broadly and non-specified that he had previously violated a court order, and that was properly admitted in a sanitized way for that limited purpose of showing the effect that it had on the victim in this case. That was directly relevant to the stalking count, as the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt whether she suffered a serious inconvenience or emotional distress. And moreover, the trial court carefully crafted that limiting instruction until it was edited and satisfied by the defense. That cannot be clearly erroneous. The references to house arrest and that, he got out also prejudiced the defendant is inaccurate. The got-out statement was made by the victim during cross-examination by trial counsel.
Attorney Hudson McRae, I see the green light's on. You packed a lot into your 3 minutes there, but I'm not...
Did my best.
You did a fine job. I just want to backtrack to a couple points. The first, regarding the evidence of Labby's prior circumstances that were you sought to get in for context. Would the fact that he was in jail, that he was in prison for violating a protective order... If you were given free rein, would you want to put that in as context during the trial?
It was violating a prior bail order, not a protection
bailer,
order.
Bailer, yeah, sure.
And I think the state...
Involving the same victim.
That is correct.
Yes.
The state wanted to make sure that the history, because the fact that the victim in this case had a court order in place prohibiting contact by the defendant to her was absolutely important for her state of mind. If the question is whether the state would have specifically sought to say Jacob Labby violated prior bail conditions by having contact with her, I don't think that's necessarily relevant. The bail condition parts of the state probably would not have specified.
Okay, so you said at the top of that, you said it would be relevant to put in the fact of the fact that there was a bail condition involving her?
I don't think the specification that it was a bail condition was necessary. I think the issue in this case for proving the stalking beyond a reasonable doubt is that for the victim's state of mind, it was terribly important that...
Okay, relevant. I just want to stop you.
Relevance.
Now let's go to 403. Is there prejudice to that? Is there a danger that the jury might spin off that and go, whoa, okay, if this guy did it before, he did it again, he's a bad cat?
With an appropriate limiting instruction, no. I think that is sufficient. And again, the court in this case didn't use bail order. It just said court order.
But even with the limiting instruction, do you think there's prejudice there?
Not substantial prejudice that is outweighed by the probative value and the relevance in this case.
I think it had to be crystal clear after the victim's comments during her testimony. You know, he's going to give him the money when he got out and all the rest of it. That there was no doubt in their mind that he had been in jail for some sort of prior something with this victim. Do you dispute that?
I'm not confident that is the impression the jury was left. Got out was referenced once, maybe twice, not terribly often in the trial. I think there's a number of inferences a jury could have made as to where Mr. Labby was from. He got out of a bad marriage. The court order could have been he had a family order that prohibited limited contact that he violated. So I don't think it's as clear as that.
But do you think it's a possible inference the jury may have drawn?
Who's to say?
Let's just assume for sake of argument that that's a possible inference they may have drawn. So you are prepared to rely upon the judge's instruction saying, you may have heard this, but it's only available for a limited purpose and not for the other purpose, and that sanitizes all that follows?
In this case, yes. And I think Justice Stewart did a very nice job crafting the limiting instruction, which I just want to reiterate, the defense was happy with that limiting instruction after they edited that down and gave that repeatedly, yes.
Now, they may not have been happy with it, but they didn't press it or preserve it, I think you're saying.
I think they were satisfied with the instruction that was given, notwithstanding their objection to the admission of the evidence, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I bring you to the de minimis argument? You say in your brief that the practice contemplated by Section 12 is for the defense to file a written motion in advance of trial. I know that was the case in the Carger matter, but looking at Section 12 itself, where are you getting that argument from?
And I neglected to include in my brief that I was reading Section 12 along with Rule 12 of the Main Rules of Unified Criminal Procedure. And then I think just general practices and making sure that the court has an adequate opportunity and the state has an adequate opportunity to make sure that this issue is properly presented to the court. So in Section 12, the language, the court may dismiss a prosecution if, and part of the language I was relying on, upon notice to or motion of the prosecutor and opportunity to be heard. In this case, the defense raised...
But that's motion of the prosecutor, or notice to the prosecutor. In other words, what is Section 12? It's not really a defense, is it?
I think it is a defense, Your Honor, yes. That's how we've always interpreted this. And if at the end of the day, the court is tasked with making, I think, specific findings and applying different standards for either A through B through C.
Well, let's apply a little logic here. I mean, aren't there... Apparently we can't. Aren't there situations where in order for the court to determine whether the de minimis statute should apply, the court needs to hear the whole shebang? So why wouldn't you be able to make the motion after at the close of the trial?
Because I think in an ideal circumstance, when you're in the heat of a jury trial, teeing this up, as the state did with a motion in limine on the 404B VCR concerns, is absolutely important. When you file a motion in advance, prior to trial, the court can say, all right, we know this issue is coming up. I can defer ruling on it until after I've heard the evidence in the case and then have a better understanding. Because I think the concern that we see we're in the middle of trial is these issues get raised. A prosecutor and the judge, frankly, may not be as thoroughly aware of the standards required by the court, have all of the Carger factors at hand or in the front of their mind on a motion for judgment of acquittal in the middle of a trial when the trial judge was dealing with carefully constructing limiting instructions, dealing with this 404B issue, and some of the other matters that just come up in the normal course. So I think the best practice that I sort of read with Rule 12 of the Rules of Unified Criminal Procedure and Section 12 is that the ideal practice in any event should be that this motion gets filed before the start of trial. If the court needs to defer ruling, as the trial courts often do, until they've heard all of that evidence, then certainly that's perfectly fine because then they would have all of the facts in front of them and they would know the Carger factors to apply if that's the appropriate provision.
Did the court here review the Carger factors and go through them?
Excuse me, Your Honor, not explicitly, no.
And there was no request for post-trial findings?
There was not in the motion for a new trial. The de minimis argument, at least as I read the motion, was not renewed, no. And so that's why I don't believe it was appropriately preserved and should be reviewed for obvious error.
So your position is then, unless the defense tees this up before the trial, it's waived and can't be raised after the evidence is concluded?
I think in this case, it was not done appropriately so. There may be other circumstances where it could be raised before trial and still not be waived, or could not be waived.
if it was to constitute an absolute bar, it may be that both parties come in expecting the trial to go this way and that. It actually doesn't. It goes this way. The evidence, we never know how the evidence is going to go when the trial starts.
That's correct.
And at the end of the trial, defense attorney may say, whoa, going into this, I thought they had, you know, a valid case here, but this is a whole different kettle of fish. I think that now this is controlled by de minimis. Would they be barred under the circumstances if they hadn't raised it in a motion prior to trial?
I'm not sure. I think, to Justice Connor's point, having the court is going to have enough of the facts to be able to make the decision. So,
well, that's not necessarily true, because let's take the Carger case. I mean, there was an allegation of gross sexual assault because he kissed his baby's penis. And so we don't have any intent mens rea. It's just a mouth and the genital. That's it, and you are guilty. But throughout the trial, it became clear that nobody thought he had any bad intent. It was completely innocuous. And if that doesn't come out until we're done, the DHHS conceded there was no issue here for the safety of the child and that nothing was meant, why isn't it okay to raise the issue at the end of the trial and say, see? Well, why is that wrong?
I don't know if it's necessarily wrong. I think in that case, and I know Your Honor argued that before the law court, in Carger, I think there's two parts. The first is what Your Honor noted about insufficient evidence. I think that's a motion for judgment of acquittal for the state failure to establish the appropriate mens rea.
There was no mens rea. There's no mens rea under that statute.
And my understanding is that in Carger, it was a bifurcated bench trial before the judge. I thought they presented there was the evidence of the gross sexual assault, and then the defense presented the de minimis evidence about the culture. And that was what the focus of Carger was. The cultural issue here it's not an issue. It's the other subsections of the Section 12 de minimis statute.
Well, but the generic question I'm asking is, aren't there situations like this where, for example, it's a strict liability kind of crime, and by the end of hearing all the evidence, you go, wow, the legislature really didn't intend this to be put under this statute, that you're just not going to know until all the evidence is in. So why isn't it okay to raise the issue when it becomes evident?
I think they can. I just think in this case, when we're raising both subsections B and C, where we have to talk about the legislative history and the Carger factors, I just think the better approach, and I can say from practice, usually opposing counsel have a sense of this. Usually opposing counsel is saying all along throughout the case, this isn't a stalking, this is de minimis, this isn't X, Y, or Z crime that's charged. And so defense counsel's been bringing it up to the prosecution. So I haven't seen a situation, Your Honor, where it's been the evidence that has come in is so completely different than what is expected that we're at that type of position. But if those circumstances presented, then perhaps it wouldn't be waived. I just think in this case, under these facts, in this procedure, the evidence didn't come in, at least my understanding, I was not trial counsel, but reading all of the transcripts, the evidence didn't come in completely different than what was expected by either side.
Does it matter to your point whether we review this under the obvious error standard or the abuse of discretion standard?
No, but I do think the obvious error standard applies. I think either way, it's not de minimis. And if there are no further questions, the state rests on the record in its brief.
Thank you. Attorney Parody, I'd be happy to hear you in rebuttal.
I won't spend a lot of time on the preservation of the de minimis argument. I do respect the fact that counsel has indicated she was not trial counsel. And I suspect if Ms. Bozeman was here, she would tell you that I vehemently, constantly for 2 years said, this is not stalking. Why are we going to trial on this charge? I even said it in front of Justice Stewart.
Did you make a motion for a dismissal?
Never done that, because you know why? The first thing the state would have said is, this is premature. The court has to hear the evidence.
Then bring the motion.
Either way.
So bring the motion after the evidence.
Can I make a motion for acquittal at the beginning of the case and say, Judge, I think the state has no evidence?
You can bring a motion as part of your motion for acquittal at the close of the state's evidence.
Exactly. And this is part of my motion for acquittal was the de minimis. So I think that issue of whether you preserve it before is just a non-issue. And unless there's other questions about my other arguments, I'm satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Parody. Attorney Hudson McRae, we understand this is your first appearance before the law court. Is that correct? We've seen your briefs in the past, but it's a pleasure to have you here. As is our tradition, we'd like to meet with you and opposing counsel in chambers afterwards to welcome you to appellate practice. We'll see you forthwith. The matter is under advisement. We'll be in recess.